Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Badass Women's Hours podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Emma Sexton and Natalie Campbell. This week, we meet the creator of Curry and Cancer, a blog helping women of Southeast Asian origin talk about their cancer diagnosis. And we meet a woman who was on Saddam Hussein's hit list, escaped, and now helps female survivors of ISIS start new lives.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
Can you imagine having to explain to your parent what cancer was after you had just been diagnosed with it? Our next guest did. She's in the studio now. Saima Thompson, lovely to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Lovely to be here, ladies.
So tell us a little bit about what you're going through right now. Tell us about the cancer you were diagnosed with.
Well, back in April this year, after a few kind of sickness symptoms, so I had upper back pain and upper chest swelling, I was diagnosed with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer.
Wow. And had you... Tell us, how did you go to your GP and say, I'm not feeling very well? What happened?
So I basically had what looked like a swollen gland. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it was actually a tumour in my lymph node, it turned out to be. But yeah, I had fatigue and then upper back pain. And those were the only signs with the cancer. And then when I went to the GP, I got my blood tested and my thyroid was playing up. So she mm-hmm. thought it could be goiter. Which is like overactive thyroid or whatever. And the kind of symptoms were kind of playing up and being inconsistent with that. The swelling increased and it got to the point where I was experiencing breathlessness in my sleep. And went to the GP after a private scan, which showed that there was nothing wrong with my thyroid. And the GP said, all right, get yourself to A&E. There's something really wrong. I'm really concerned about your breathing. So yeah, went to A&E and they gave me a CT scan, and there it was. I had masses in my lymph node, my lung, bone and liver.
Wow. So yeah,
and they got to work really quickly. So once the doctors know, you know, mm-hmm. this could be cancer, they worked really fast. They took biopsies, etc. And within, I think it's 2 to 3 weeks, I think they were a bit like, are you sure this is lung cancer? The doctor, the people that deal with the biopsies were a bit strange about coming back very quickly. But yeah, within 3 weeks, I knew that it was stage 4 lung cancer. It was really shocking. Like, even the doctors wouldn't.
Because you're very young to get lung cancer, or that type of lung cancer, is that right?
Yeah, it is quite, I am a rare case. So I think about 5% of cases are under 40.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm the exception. But it's on the rise in females, and in the last 3 years as well, you'll find that up to 28% of cases are now non-smoking.
Really? Do they know what's causing that at all?
I think there's still, because this is like new statistics that have just come out in the last few weeks from Roy Castle Lung Cancer Foundation. I think it's environmental. It's got to be air pollution. It's got to be bio reasons why it's on the rise, especially in non-smokers
mm-hmm.
and
so
females.
So were you a smoker or no?
I dabbled with cigarettes in my 20s, like every other 20-something year old.
Yep.
I hadn't been smoking for about 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So it got me.
And so just listening to you, as you were, you know, from the first time you went to your GP and said, you know, there's sort of swelling here and back pain, to getting to A&E, did you at any point think there was something wrong other than the breathlessness? Because I've always thought that if you had cancer, and I feel like this is leading into the story about your mum saying, well, what is it? My assumption would be that you'd know, you'd be quite ill, you'd be quite sick, especially if it was lung cancer. But it sounds like, you know, you could have probably gone a bit longer without knowing.
So lung cancer in particular, it's usually staged quite late because it doesn't present itself very well. Mm. It's quite a tricky one because I think with things like breast cancer, prostate cancer, you can, you know, copper feel, grab your balls, you know, there's lumps and bumps you can look out for. Mm. But with lung cancer, it's obviously a gland. Mm. And it's just very tricky to detect.
Okay, to back up. So lung cancer is connected to glands.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I didn't know that.
Yeah, so, it's like there's tumours in my body, but I've never felt physical tumours apart from when it's metastasised to my lymph node.
Okay.
Which is, that was one of the first indications that something was wrong.
And where is the lymph node?
So you have lymph nodes all through your you have a lymphatic system in your body. So this one in particular was near my neck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so Nat mentioned this. When you were diagnosed, you told your mum, what was her reaction?
So her reaction was she just thought I had the flu or something. She didn't understand what lung cancer was. It's not that she's, you know, thick or anything. She just lacked medical knowledge. And you'd find that with a lot of immigrant parents. She'd come here in the 80s, raised 4 children.
Where did she come from?
She's from Pakistan originally. Yep. So both my parents are Pakistani. And, you know, she just lacks health knowledge and health awareness. Whereas I'm obviously born here. I know what cancer is, unfortunately, and I kind of actually admired her ignorance to the disease almost. She was like, oh, it's okay, you know, you'll be fine. And I was like, Mum, it's incurable. It's not going to go anywhere. Like, obviously, at the time, I was quite sick. So just trying to get across, like, the severity of what I had was quite difficult on top of dealing with the cancer itself.
Yeah. And did she get to a point of understanding? What was her reaction then?
There's a moment, I think I've got a blog covering cancer. And I wrote about my experience with that. And there was a moment where she was massaging my back and it was very, very swollen. And she could tell that it was swollen from internal, you know, it wasn't just like an external swelling. And then that's when I had a skin rash at the time. And she turned around and she said, I understand, like the spots are inside you. And that was her way of understanding that I had growths or tumours inside, as opposed to, like at the time, I take this... a targeted therapy drug called afatinib, and that just gives me quite a manageable skin rash. You can see, you know, I live with it, but at the time she just thought I had chickenpox.
Wow.
So, you know, I had a lot to contend with, and I think it's just health awareness in the South Asian community. I think you find that in a lot of BAME communities anyway. There is a lack of understanding, especially when it comes to certain diseases, and a level of ignorance as well.
And we're going to keep talking to Saima here on Badass Women's Hour XL.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Welcome back to Badass Women's Hour XL with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton. We're talking to Saima Thompson about being diagnosed with lung cancer. So you said you worked through the diagnosis. Where are you with it now? What treatment have you been through and how are you feeling now?
So... I had, between the oncologist telling me the diagnosis and the treatment, I had 2 hours and I had my first radiotherapy session. And I didn't even know what it meant.
Did they tell you, was that literally like, okay, we're getting you in now because otherwise you're going to die?
No, I think they were just being efficient. They were like, well, we've got a slot, so might as well just zap the thing now. And then, so I had 5 radiotherapy sessions to zap my kind of primary lung tumour, the naughty one. And then from there on, I saw a specialist oncologist and I'm on a treatment plan, which is a pill a day, which sounds really easy. I'll call it a chemo pill because the side effects are quite, you know, they're hard to manage at times. So I take antibiotics to counter them and I get diarrhea, I get a skin rash, I get a kind of sore nail beds. But apart from that, I am stable health-wise. So generally in the cancer community, they say you're as good as your last scan. So my last scan showed stability, no growth. So, you know, I'm living well.
And so can you then live with it? Is that what stability is? Do they give you, sorry to be dark, but do they give you a prognosis on it?
So the initial prognosis was 6 to 12 months without treatment.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was pretty bad. Yeah. And then they said, the doctor said 2 to 3 years with treatment. But again, statistics are just statistics. Yeah. Yeah. And it's changing constantly every day. So you've got things like immunotherapy. You've got so many new advances every day in the, you know, in the cancer world. So I live in hope that, you know, maybe I can live longer. Yeah. I don't know. So, have to go with it.
You're very blasé about it, I have to say. I'm like, I'm in awe of you. You're just, it seems like you've got a really good handle on just being here and now.
Yeah, I'd say it took a lot of effort though.
Yeah.
I've had therapy for, you know, I say with any stage 4 diagnosis, I think people, you need therapy. You need to process that because your mortality is literally in front of you. Mm. And coping with that sort of, you know, diagnosis, especially at my age, I was just like, you know, I was just kind of thriving. I was finding myself. I run a restaurant in South London called Masala Wala Cafe, and I was just finding my feet. And I was actually just opened a second business just before the diagnosis. So I was kind of like on my way to, like, you know, achieving my kind of entrepreneurial dreams. And then it really did, you know, cliche, take the rug under my feet. And I had to kind of go back to zero again and go, right, what do I do now? You know, so I had to close the new business. It was a project that I'd got involved. I got involved with another business partner. I had to close, and just the family business is still here to this day. But yeah, I had to get therapy. I was actually suffering with panic attacks at the time as well. You know, it's a high anxiety
thing
to deal with.
Yeah, a bit stressful. Yeah.
How has a diagnosis changed your attitude and how you are living life? Because, like you say, you're living with cancer now and you're doing really, really well. What decisions do you make differently now? Is your outlook radically changed in terms of how you're running your business, how you're living your life?
I think I am a lot more. I'm like, there's a bigger picture now, guys. You know, it's when you go through cancer like this, it does just open up your eyes to how fragile we all are and how vulnerable we can all be. And I'm looking to be more kinder, more loving, and I can just see the bigger picture now. I'm not worried about the kind of the day to day rigmaroles. Obviously, yeah, I still get upset if I get a paper cut, like everyone else. You know, that's upsetting. But it's just like, I think it does bring you back to the present a little bit. And I'm going, like, I have my plans till Christmas. Mm-hmm. I'm opening up the January slowly. You know, I turn 30 in January. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a great time. But I'm just keeping it pretty micro. Whereas maybe before I'd be a bit more ambitious. I'd be like, right, I'm going Glastonbury. I'm like, now I'm like, I'm not sure if I can make Glastonbury. Let's just pencil that in, shall we? So, yeah.
Amazing. And you're, in terms of how you communicate with your mum on a daily basis about how you're feeling or not feeling, is that just an ongoing journey? And is it the same for other family members too?
My sister, actually, one of my sisters is with me today, Nafisa. My family are my worlds. I'm like ridiculously close to them. I have 3 sisters and my mum, so we're like a bit of a pack. We're like the Spice Girls, but without the different hair colours. My mum, I feel a lot closer to her, and I feel like she understands more. Mm-hmm. Because, like, before we probably bicker about silly things about the business, so I actually run my restaurant with her.
Right.
So it's her recipes, home cooking, Pakistani food. And yeah, we'd like bicker about silly things like the menu. She'd be like, no, better, we're going to do this. And, you know, stuff like that. But now it's a bit like, it's a lot more loving, our relationship. And me and my sisters, I think just the way I'm coping with it, I hope it kind of filters out to them and they will find some reason with this, because it's heavy stuff, cancer. Maybe I'm smiling and stuff, but it is heavy. And I've had to, you know, do a lot of work to, you know, get to this point and accept the diagnosis. So I think, yeah, hopefully my positivity will just kind of fill around them.
I was listening to you, but I was also saying to Harriet, I think we should bring your sister in.
Oh,
if she's willing, the offer's there for her to pop in and give her version.
Come in
and say hi. You know, you said how close,
like,
you are to your family.
I thought we were just
going
for a glass of wine, babe.
Hi, welcome. Join the mic.
We'd love to hear from you if you're able to kind of position yourself in front of the microphone. Yeah. Just how it was for you when your sister got this diagnosis and she told you about it. How did it change things for you?
I think one way to put it was before the diagnosis, I felt like I was asleep pre-diagnosis. And then following that, I feel like we've just gone through such a journey this year that I've learnt so much. So I'm 22 and I just feel so wise beyond my years because I've had to share this journey with like my three older sisters. Aww. And just learn so much about ourselves as well as how you should go about life really. Mm-hmm. And like cutting out kind of negative energies and negative people and just focusing on what's important. So that's just, it's actually been such a great year. At the same time, it's been a shock, but it's been really good as well, the way we've managed it and gone through this whole stage of acceptance.
Has it made you closer?
So I didn't think this was possible because we were already really close, but I'd say yes, like much closer. Yeah. Big time.
Yeah. And Simon, what do you think is, I guess, what would you like other people who are going through a similar experience or whose family are going through a similar experience to kind of learn or take away from them?
I think in life, you know, we, like my sister said, sleepwalking. Yeah. I think until you've had some sort of life shock, you're almost sleepwalking. But we need to realise that every day is a gift. Mm. And I suppose our experiences as a family, every day is a gift. It really is. And just to be more purposeful and meaningful and willing to share with other people, that's what's going to make you feel like you're going to have no regrets later on in life, you know, when you're... Yeah. If you obviously grace with old age, I'm not sure if I will be, but, you know, and you look back on your life, usually the regrets are going to be about love,
yeah.
Right? It's about love. That's what life is all about. And that's what I'm learning already at the age of 29. I think people sometimes go through their whole life and they don't have this lesson. Mm. But obviously we've been blessed with this lesson now.
Yeah. Has it made you more aware of your own health? Has it worried you? Has it made you kind of think about how you look after yourself?
Just knowing the statistic itself that 1 in 2 people will be affected by cancer, that was a shock because I thought, obviously, it didn't hit as many people. And to be honest, before the diagnosis, I didn't know anyone who was young with cancer. Mm. That really got to me, did get me reflecting on how it could hit anyone, and it made it a reality. In terms of health, I think me and my sisters, we've always kind of been conscious about, you know, exercising and just eating well, really. Because obviously food for us is a very big thing, yeah. Of course, with the restaurant. So it's only just reinforced our thoughts on that.
Yeah. And Sammy, you started a blog to talk about it, Currying Cancer. How has that helped you?
So I started it as a way to kind of process my thoughts. So I talk about all sorts of things on there because cancer touches all elements of your life. So I spoke about the business, you know, how to close something down and how I got on with that. I spoke about family, spoke about obviously speaking to my mum, you know, my culture, which was a big thing as well because I found that there wasn't enough kind of BME voices when it comes to illness.
Mm.
I feel like you know, Black, Asian, ethnic women, yeah. And men have a level of fear when it comes to talking about illness. You know, we don't want to kind of come across as weak. Coming from immigrant communities, there's a lot of confusion. So I spoke about those experiences, and most recently I spoke about acceptance. So again, it's like it's a progressive thing. Every time I kind of get inspired by my experiences, you know, being on the other side,
yeah.
I'll just kind of share words. And
do you think illness is more hidden in those Black, Asian, minority ethnic communities? Is it just that it's not talked about, or is it that it's kind of, we'll just deal with it at home?
I think it's not talked about enough.
Yeah.
I think the conversations aren't being had. And it goes to show because I think, you know, for me, you know, I'm just one example,
yeah.
Of so many stories out there. There's so many Asian Black women, men. And, you know, especially in the Afro-Caribbean communities, you know, 1 in 4 men are going to get prostate cancer.
Yeah.
So
again, those conversations aren't being had because men are very proud. They're very, you know, alpha male typically. And we can't get away from that. We need to have these conversations. The lung cancer that I have in particular is the EGFR mutation. It's most common in non-smoking Asian women, you know. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really, I thought only white people got cancer. I genuinely did because the media and the material say so. Yeah. There's just not enough diversity in illness.
It's a good point, though. Like you say, if you're thinking, if you're not seeing anything advertised or talked about and what you're seeing, then you would go, well, this is probably something that's not going to affect me, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking when you said that stat about prostate cancer, and I was thinking my understanding of prostate cancer is Movember, which is a great charity grow a moustache thing in November that goes on, but is entirely run and covered and promoted by white men.
Why white men? Yeah. But the real problems are in Afro-Caribbean communities. Yeah. And I think I was speaking to Errol McKellar, who runs a foundation from his garage in East London. So I could talk about him. So he started giving MOT discounts to his customers for getting their prostate checked.
Yes, I've heard about him. Yes. Amazing man. Yeah.
And he said that the stats are even worse back in the homelands in Jamaica. Yeah. In the Caribbean, it's up to 1 in 3 to 1 in 2.
Wow. Okay.
Men.
I think men would rather not get checked. And I say that we didn't actually say that my granddad had prostate cancer until he'd gone through all of the treatment and was cleared. And then we were like, oh, by the way, Uncle Baba, we call him Uncle Baba, had prostate cancer. But while he had it, we just didn't talk about it.
That's his thing.
Yeah. Did he not want to talk about it? Was it just as a family he didn't want to talk about it?
He didn't want to talk about it. Mm. The only reason we spoke about it was because the medication that he was on made him angry.
Mm-hmm.
And his personality was just different. And so we sort of had to say, well, he's on this medication. But yeah, as a family, it was sort of, yeah, his prostate levels are high is what we'd say.
Do you think that's changed the attitude of the men in your family to how do I get checked? How do I look after myself?
No, because my uncle had bowel cancer. And again, he, so they, in fact, they both had the cancer at the same time.
Yeah. Wow.
And he pretty much was like,
don't mention it.
Once he had the surgery, we didn't mention it until he got the all clear. And a year later, he sent and sort of an I've gone all clear text message.
Yeah.
And then we were sent back, great. And no one's ever mentioned it since. And only talking about it, I'm like, how do I broach this around the Christmas dinner table this year? My other uncle was in hospital with pneumonia and, you know, he tried to check himself out. So he refused to stay in hospital, even though he knew he had pneumonia. And he would never get his prostate checked. He said he'd rather just die.
Wow.
Yeah. So everything you're saying, it resonates.
Yeah. It's such a treatable cancer as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just amazing to hear that from just, you know, a conversation with you. Mm-hmm. So there's just so many stories out there. Mm-hmm. As soon as I kind of came out, it's a coming out, right? It's a coming out thing. Mm-hmm. My auntie told me that her mother had breast cancer twice and her father actually died of bone cancer. And we're quite close to her, you know. You know, to the point where she makes pickles for my restaurant.
Right.
You know, and we're close to her. It's not like random auntie number 5.
Yeah.
It's I know this woman, and she never ever told me the cause of death for her father.
Wow.
So how am I to know if we're not having these conversations amongst our families and communities and friends?
What do you think stops it? Is it I guess for me, my kind of lack of understanding point is, what is it that makes it unacceptable to talk about?
Well, there's a few factors. I'd say there's shame.
Yeah.
So there's a shame factor. Everyone wants to kind of show their best side. And I think that goes for all cultures anyway. People
Absolutely.
Don't want to talk about when they're down and out.
Yeah.
I think there's an immigrant mentality. We don't want to show weakness. And that kind of rubs off on the
generation below.
The offsprings as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm second generation Pakistani.
Yeah.
And my dad was very much like, you know, he came here at age 15, worked in the paper mills, then was an entrepreneur. He worked really, really hard. We never saw him. And then that kind of rubs off on you as well. And you don't want to show weakness, I suppose. And you want to kind of leaven up to your kind of white peers.
Yeah.
And then again, there's a lack of knowledge with my mother, obviously not knowing what cancer was. Because again, not health savvy.
Yeah.
Our elders, we're talking the generation that have come here like in the 80s and 70s. Mm-hmm. It's changing now.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel like. I'm here, I'm born, I'm from Gravesend in Kent.
Yeah.
So I feel like, times are changing, but very slowly, because we still have that kind of ingrained, it's like a deep ingrained mentality
of what, you know, what we should be, we should and shouldn't talk about. You know, in my culture particular, there's a saying, "Lorgyakengir," which is what will they say?
Yeah.
You know, and that's very like, it's hard to kind of deprogram that mentality.
Yeah.
I think also cancer's a very difficult topic to talk about. And I feel like, you know, you're on their podcast soon. That's with Deborah James and Lauren talking about cancer more. But I feel like it's going to be one in two of us. And if we don't get comfortable around talking about the cancer conversation, people will die unnecessarily. But there is this taboo about it, because I think people automatically just hear the word cancer and they go straight to the worst case scenario. But actually, like you say, treatments are better. There's a majority of people are living really well with cancer. And, you know, they're the conversations we need to be having. But I think there's just this really dark fear around the C word, isn't there, for everybody?
We've got to, it's a disease. That's all it is, essentially. Yeah. We have to change what it means. I thought I was going to die straight away when I got the diagnosis, because I didn't know what it meant to live with it. But I am living with it now. And through the internet, which is amazing, I've found people like Deborah James you know, Lauren Mahon. After a few months of being in the woods, luckily I was like, okay, I'm young. Check the internet out. What's happening out there? There is a community online, which is fantastic. And you can live with it. That's the point.
We've actually got Michelle on the line. Her mother-in-law has cancer. Michelle, what's happening with your family?
Well, this is a really new diagnosis for us, and I have to say, I've literally just turned the radio on, Seema, and your story is so sad, but so similar to what my mother-in-law is currently experiencing. She's 74, so considerably older, but I feel awkward ringing because you can't compare the ages, but she had lumps come up on her neck. That was one of the first things that she noticed. Mm. I didn't hear all of your story, so I'm not entirely sure how you realised that you were ill. But she went to the doctors and they did scans, and hers is also lung cancer. She's been told stage four. The issue is with us is that she lives in Spain, and she's adamant that she's going to have her treatment over there. She thinks her doctors over there are going to give her this miracle tablet that's perhaps going to give her another 10 years. It's completely unrealistic. The size of the tumour in her chest is pushing against her esophagus. She's got grandchildren over here, and we're trying to convince her to come back and have her treatment in the UK so she can be with loved ones. The only person she's got over there is her husband and some friends. But she's adamant that she's going to have her treatment over there. We've got no realistic idea of what her prognosis is. The doctor unhelpfully really said 1 to 2 years, and she's grabbed on to the 2 years, and she thinks if her medication works, she will have longer. I'm thinking that it's probably in a more progressive state than... You know, she's not eating.
It's so difficult. I mean, you know, obviously I'm like on the other side of it. So it's, you know, for me, I'm trying to empathise with my family as well as they go through things. I think the first thing is that you need to respect her wishes. Obviously, she's been quite dramatic, and it's, you know, the circumstances are quite severe, but respect her wishes at this stage, because, you know, it is her cancer. It's so difficult for you as a loved one to, you know, grasp hold of that. But that, I would say, you know, go with what she wants. And that's, if that's her wish to be there. And you obviously, you said, you know, she's got a husband and she's got friends. When it comes to struggling, just be there for her and just let her know that you're there. And when it comes to a struggle for her, then make those sorts of arrangements to possibly, you know, have her by your side. It's so difficult, obviously, having a loved one overseas like that.
Oh, Simon, that's fabulous advice. Thank you. And I think you're totally right. It's difficult, but you've got to let people go through it, I guess, in their own way. Michelle, I hope that was helpful. Thank you so much for sharing with us. We really appreciate it. Simon, we've loved having you on. Thank you so much.
Amazing.
If people want to read your blog, find out more about you, where should they be looking?
So I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. It's @CurryAnnCancer. The blog is www.curryanncancer.com.
curryandcancer.com because no one else took it. And my restaurant is in Broccoli in South London, Masala Walla Cafe, and that's www.masalawallacafe.co.uk at Masala Walla Cafe. Beautiful. Thanks, ladies.
Thank you so much.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The Fempire strikes back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
You know, sometimes you hear a life story and you're like, I feel like I'm not hearing this correctly. So I want to take you back to kind of 1986. The Iraq War was happening, the war with Iran, and Iraq was attacking Kurdish towns with poison gas, so killing thousands of people. But we are lucky enough to have in the studio with us now one woman who survived and escaped the genocide, came to the UK, and is now doing incredible things for other women in the region. Taban Shiresh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your childhood. Where you came from?
Well, it's a very long story, so I'll try and cut it quite short. So in 1986, we were caught with my mum and my grandparents, and we were put in prison because my father was a Peshmerga, so a freedom fighter, but also a political activist poet. So we were on the most wanted list, on Saddam Hussein's list, and the way they would try and capture the men was to capture the families to try and get information out of them and capture the men and kill them. So we were caught for 2 weeks, and the adults were interrogated to try and get information out of them. They didn't give anything away, and we were meant to be buried alive after the 2 weeks. We had a miraculous escape, and after that we went into hiding for about 3 months. And it's at that point when my mum put her foot down and said, well, we've got the death sentence on us. We need to leave this country. I can't stay in hiding forever. And then we made our way to be smuggled into Iran so we could go reach safety. And my dad was going to meet us, but he was poisoned by a husband and wife that Saddam Hussein had hired. And he and two other men were critically ill. Two died on the spot in the region at the actual dinner. And they were smuggled into Iran as well. And Amnesty International picked up on that story and flew him to the UK to get medical treatment. And so he came to the UK in 1987, and we had to wait for him to survive. And we ended up here in 1988. Wow. That's the short synopsis.
The short version.
That is incredible. And so your family have been in the UK since 1988, and you, I guess, grew up and were living, until recently, I'm going to say, a relatively normal life. You were a digital project manager, had a good job. Tell us what you're doing now.
So I'd say a normal, safe, stable life. Ended up working in the city. And in August 2014, when the humanitarian crisis started in Iraq with ISIS going into the region, I decided to leave my city job and go back and take my son and help with a local foundation there. And they did incredible work. On my first day, we were delivering aid and rescuing people on a mountain, on Mount Sinjar, that were trapped on the mountain. And for the next 15 months, they built schools, camps, did so much, and it was very frontline. So when I came back to the UK, it was very, very alien for me not to do anything. So I decided to set up the Lotus Flower to help women and girls who were impacted by conflict and displacement. And I started in my living room with no money. And I'm not exactly rich, so I don't have lots of money to invest in something like this. I was lucky to have one donor to support one project to be started. And that project basically snowballed into now three centres. And in less than 2 years, we've managed to help over 3,000 women.
What is the sort of things that you see from those girls that have been through that trauma? What do they come to the centres with, I guess?
So the women and girls that we're currently supporting in the three centres in Kurdistan, Northern Iraq, they're all ISIS survivors. So they're the women and girls that have been rescued from ISIS. They were raped, sold on as sex slaves. All of them have been forced to leave their homes. Most have seen their families killed in front of them. So they're severely, severely traumatized. And the centres provide a safe social space for them to do so much. It brings them together, so their shared experiences help them rebuild their lives, but also the opportunities that we give in terms of education and livelihood programmes and peace building and human rights access activities just gives them access to tools that they would never normally have. And actually, for women and girls, it's really difficult to be in camps because there's nothing for them to do. They're literally inside the cabins or tents 24 hours, 7 days a week. They've got cultural and social pressures on them. They've got other struggles like early forced marriage, gender-based violence. So there's a lot of pressure on them. And so the centres are critical to actually give them a hub where they can congregate, be social and learn things.
I'm listening to you just absolutely blown away by the work that you're doing. How did you decide that you were going to spend 15 months essentially doing this work? Because I'm sure there are lots of people that in a fleeting moment think, I want to help. But it's difficult to go from I want to help to I'm getting on a plane and I can now spend 15 months somewhere, especially with a child. How old was your son at the time?
So my son just finished primary school, so he would have been going on to 12. Mm-hmm. I think for me, because of my past experience, mm-hmm. I've more or less come very close to death. Mm-hmm. So that fear in me has somewhat gone. Mm-hmm. And I just believe that something was pushing me. There was an emptiness inside of me where I needed to experience that. And those 15 months working with Rwanda in the region was one of the best times of my life. And actually, it was life-changing because it reminded me of what I can do and what I've been through and what change is possible. So it triggered so much, and that triggered what I'm doing now. I wouldn't have been able to help 3,000 women if I didn't have that experience. So actually putting my life at risk just woke me up.
How do you cope with operating in those two worlds? Because sometimes I feel, I live in a bubble of my life in London, and I see pictures around the world, and sometimes I really struggle to comprehend of people living in such, desperate, awful, situations and not being able to live their life as freely as I can. But it's a really difficult thing to grasp. How do you find being over there and then coming back to your life in London? Is it difficult to be between those two worlds?
It's really strange because when I first arrived in the UK, you end up developing and you have certain experiences that blocked my past out completely. So I completely blocked it. And then in August 2014, that all came rushing back from what I'd experienced. But when I came back 15 months later, I couldn't function. When I got to London for 3 months, I would go on the tube just looking at people going, why are you actually moaning? There's nothing to be moaning about. You've got nothing to moan about. Or it really took 3 months for me to really adjust to the normal things that we do here. And then suddenly I just realized, actually, this is the reality of it. You can't choose what you're given in life. and you can't feel guilty about it, what can I do to make a positive difference? So I thought, well, I can be that bridge. I can be that bridge between this world and that world. Instead of feeling guilty about stuff, how do I turn something into a positive experience and enable that to help there? So for example, I don't know, it could be an event that we do. You know, you normally go to events, but I could charge tickets at that event, which actually fundraises to what we're doing in the region. So my perspective on it changed, and that's what really helped.
And how easy is it for, like, for somebody like myself to go out there and help? Is that an easy thing for us to do? Should more people be out there supporting and creating that bridge?
I think it's easy. I think it's easy if you know. I would recommend that you would go knowingly and with knowledge. We've taken people out. We've just taken a few influencers out there. It's the region that we're in, the Kurdish region, is very safe. But obviously it would be very scary for somebody who doesn't know anything about the region. And this particular person that we took, you know, they had a whole perception of a war zone. But when they got there, they were completely surprised at what they were experiencing. As with any region, you just have to be knowledgeable, stay safe, know where you're going, have contacts and local contacts. So if anyone was to go out there for us, we would make sure that they have all the information and they're connected to what we're doing to keep them safe as possible.
Okay, we're going to keep chatting to Tavanna after the break.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
And we are chatting to Tavanna Suresh, all about her incredible life and the brilliant, brilliant work she is doing with young female ISIS survivors. Tell us, so you've set up centres to help. You've got three at the moment. What is happening in those centres? What skills are you giving them? What skills do you give these young women?
These centres are a hub of activity. If you go and see and experience it in the morning, it'll turn into daily exercise, and then it switches into adult literacy, and then it changes to a mini factory for sewing sisters, and then it turns into boxing sisters. So it really alternates, and we really make use of these spaces. For example, adult literacy is for women that have never been to school. They've never, ever picked up a pen in their life, and they've never had the opportunity back in their regions because it was very rural and there's no adult education. This course is oversubscribed because they all want to read and write, and this is their opportunity. They're thinking, well, I'm stuck in a camp. I might as well learn something. And basic things like knowing how to read who's calling them on their phone, or prescriptions. And then Sewing Sisters, this is a project that the women actually requested. A lot of them have lost their male or family members that were breadwinners for them, and they want to be able to earn an income to support their children. And so the ones that don't know how to read and write, they'll go through the adult literacy to learn to do the measurements, and then they do 3 months of intense sewing. And then we give them a sewing machine, but we don't actually just stop there. We bring local contracts into the camp, so they have contracts to work in and earn an income, mm-hmm. so to finish the whole market linkage circle. And then the daily exercise, I think, is so important because they don't have anywhere to do any form of exercise. And you've got cultural pressures that won't allow them to do it outside the centres. So we thought we'd bring it inside the centres. We do lots of awareness sessions, empowerment sessions, legal, health, hygiene, and anything that they actually require. And I don't try and impose things on them. It's more we work collaboratively to figure out what they want and what they need. For example, next year we might be going to Bangladesh to set up a centre there, and I can't say, oh, actually, what we've implemented, the projects that we've implemented in Kurdistan will work in Bangladesh, because you'd need to do an assessment to see what will work there.
How do you determine where to set the centres up? So Bangladesh, for example, why there?
Because it mainly comes from people that, I mean, obviously where the humanitarian crisis exists, where camps are, because we specifically set up centres inside camps. So wherever there's a camp around the world, but where there's more desperate need, so that service is not given to a full degree. We've had a few people approach us for Bangladesh and ask us to set a centre there. So for a few people to come and ask us, there must be clearly a need, and we'd need to go out and do an assessment. But with Kurdistan, because I was there for 15 months, I knew the immense need. And so I started from where I knew.
Can I ask you, you obviously, you were born in Iraq and you had this, you know, incredibly terrifying childhood experience of having to flee and being arrested and being, I mean, just on the Saddam Hussein's most wanted list. How did you feel about Iraq when you were growing up, and did your experience, has your experience there now changed that?
So Iraq as a whole, it's the Kurdish region, so I'm Kurdish, and yep. It's often when somebody asks me where you're from, I'd say I'm Kurdish. Yep. And they'd say, where's that?
Yeah.
Kurdistan. Yeah. But it's not on the map. I know, but it's still Kurdistan to me. Yeah. So that has been also, that's been a massive part of my childhood growing up, is not having where yep. you're from on the map. And so you're put into a region that's actually yep. yours, but not yours. But we've always been very connected to that region. I think from what I've experienced in my past, you can't completely forget it. Yep. But I think one thing that I was taught through my family was to, you know, be 50-50. This is home for me as well. Yep. The UK is home, and so I've settled here. But you could never forget your roots as well. So I think the way that I'm working now is being that built bridge between two places that I call home.
Yeah. So tell us, we have to ask about boxing. It doesn't seem likely to me that boxing is being taught in your incredible camps in Kurdistan, but it is. How did that come about?
Yes. So the women and girls that we work with are, you know, they faced so much trauma. Yeah. They've got so many emotions trapped in them. We offer them other mental health services, and we try and do things which are good for mental health, but not directly. This is therapy as well. Because therapy is taken in different forms in different cultures.
Yeah.
And I thought boxing is amazing. Why not boxing? Because it's good for your mental health. It's good for your confidence boosting. It will channel your energy, that emotion, that anger that they've got inside them. It ticks every single box. Why don't we do this? And I think it would be really, really good for this group of women. And then we could train some women inside the camps to become instructors, and then we can hire them and they can be leading the sessions going forward. So it turns into an income generating project. And so we started it, tested it out, and it was really, really, really well received. But obviously the issue that we're facing is that there's no female boxing instructors in the region. So this is why we need Kathy Brown to come and help us teach the women to become instructors so they can continue the sessions.
But how come boxing? Because I'm thinking to myself, well, there's lots of different sports or exercise that you could do and train other people to do. So what was it that really anchored boxing for you as being the right sport to do it?
Maybe because it doesn't exist in the region.
Right, yeah.
I think, you know, it's the Kurds are very well known for having female fighters around the world, especially with what went on recently. So I thought, well, I'm not going to endorse fighting. Obviously, you can't as an NGO. But what kind of sport gives that sense of strength to someone, gives that strength back to them, and it's also breaking some sort of boundary in that region, but sending a very strong message as well. And boxing just seemed to be the right sport for that.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist in the region, and I don't see why it shouldn't. It's been very well received. We've had no negativity towards it. And
I don't think anyone would dare, would they?
Punch on the nose.
Yeah. What happens kind of after this, though? Do you then need to create kind of female boxing centres? Does it?
No, we will continue to offer it in our centres as a project. I think that's the beauty of the centres inside camps, is you don't realise how desperately it's needed. And actually, international organisations, once the first phase of the humanitarian crisis is over, they tend to leave.
Yeah.
And they tend to leave these centres or, you know, spaces. Yeah. And once they've left it, for me, I can't believe it, because I'm thinking, well, hold on, there's still people here. They're going to be here for a good few years. They still need some sort of support. And so that's why we focused on long-term support within the actual centres inside camps. And I don't think we need separate boxing centres. We can implement it in our centres as a project.
Just amazing. And I'm... Do you need equipment other than Kathy? Because you need the trainers. Do you need equipment? What other resources do you need, or is it just you need a woman on the ground that can show all the other women the basics?
So at the moment, we need to raise funds mm-hmm. to help us get Kathy to the region to mm-hmm. train them. But also, Kathy wants to raise enough to sustain one whole women's centre.
Yeah.
So our target for that is 40,000. Mm-hmm. So the first priority would be to get Kathy out there so we can actually start training the women to become instructors. Equipment, we would love equipment. It's a little bit harder shipping that equipment across. Mm. So ideally the funds are available so we can buy it there.
Right.
So that would be the best option. Mm-hmm. But I think at the moment it's more fundraising to get the centre running and to get Kathy out there to train the women so they can earn an income. And part of the money that we raise will be for the salary of the person that we train for, the boxing instructor, who will be someone from within the camp.
I love the fact that all of the work that you're doing, you're thinking about sustainability and supporting the women to generate their own incomes, because I guess the dream with your work is that you no longer need to be there, because it means the women and their families have returned to somewhere that they consider home and set up a life. And so that element of teaching them how to generate income and have things that support them for the rest of their lives and their futures is really important versus the sticky plaster approach.
Yeah, I think for me, that also comes from personal experience. I'm a single mum, and the only thing that's got me through my life is being able to work and earning an income. And that's not possible if I didn't have the skills, if I didn't know the skills. So for me, from a personal perspective, I know how important that is. And there isn't, sadly, in many parts of the world, there isn't that much support for women and, you know, a lot of single mums and girls, for that matter. So I think the only way to help them is to give them the tools to be able to train in some sort of way where they can earn an income, because that income is their freedom and their future.
I agree, Tavannah. It's been absolutely amazing having you in the studio with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
If people want to find out more about the project, if they want to donate, where should they be looking?
So if they want to find out more about the project and us, they can go to www.thelotusflower.org. And then if they want to donate, it's www.thelotusflower.org/donateboxingsisters.
Fabulous. Great. Thank you so much. It is an incredible life story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. And
thank you.
Just thank you for doing all the great work you're doing.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed listening to you. 1, 2, 3, 4. This has been the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton. If you want to hear more from us, you can come follow us on social media at Badass Women's Hour HR, or leave us a review and tell us how much you love us. We really need to feel the love. 5 stars should do it.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.